Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Dead Man's Favor by Chris Tulbain, narrated by Joel Richards. What Came Before, in which John Smith gives a recap, footnotes added by Juliet Middleton. A few years ago, I was just a perfectly ordinary, if thoroughly likable, private investigator. Thoroughly likable? Nobody's buying it, little bird. Then crab people tried to kill me, a vampire saved my life, and things started to get weird. The vampire, Anastasia Dumanova, a woman every bit as lovely as her name, told me I was San Diego's last remaining mediator. Oh, for God's sakes! The fact that I wasn't a mediator, but had merely bought a Yellow Pages ad that included mediation in its flashy headline, apparently didn't matter. Not to the people trying to kill me, or the people who needed my help. And so, my career as a supernatural mediator officially began. That first case showed me just how strange this new job could be. I was called to mediate between the local vampire house, of which Anastasia was a high-ranking member, and Lord Beelkasan, a demigod of nightmares, terror, and vindication, who appeared to everyone else as their greatest fear, and to me as a 7-foot-tall spear of asparagus. A high-ranking member, as in one of many, including me. Yeah, we're all still trying to figure that one out.
I've stopped even trying.
Anyway, I bumbled my way through the mediation, but managed to find Lord Beelkasan's Nintendo, whose theft had started the whole dispute, and even uncovered a conspiracy within the vampire house to overthrow their admittedly awful leader, the exiled queen, Lucia Borghese.
What the hell? I haven't even been mentioned yet. Agreed on Lucia's awfulness, at least. She's... not going to read this, is she?
With the traitors unmasked, the coup was launched too early, and after more than a few tense moments, the good guys managed to triumph. And yeah, I put good guys in italics for a reason. Because after saving the day, Lucia rewarded me by trying to make me her human thrall, forced to serve her for the rest of my life. No wonder people had tried to depose her. Thankfully, and owing to the same genetic quirk that seemed to make me immune to most forms of compulsion, the bond didn't end up functioning quite the way Lucia expected it to. Without this, you'd have been a snack on day one. Guaranteed. We were connected, yeah, emotionally and mentally. But I kept my free will. And you'd better believe I used it to get the hell away from Lucia. Any rational person would have seen that whole experience as a flashing neon sign telling them to get the hell out of the supernatural mediation business. And that was exactly what I planned to do. Until a pixie came along with her own problems that needed solving. Kristen was too cute to say no to, proving once again that most men are idiots.
Never say yes to a pixie. Even babies know better.
Anyway, a few months after that, I ran into the vampires again, with Lucia having tracked me down to force me to behave as a proper thrall before she lost face with the rest of the supernatural population.
And me, again feeling like chopped liver here.
And while I initially told her to go to hell, I soon got into a spot of trouble that had me reaching out to the vampires for assistance. A simple adultery case had somehow grown into a divorce mediation for a werewolf pack, and now big furry monsters were doing their best to kill me. With the help of Anastasia, who I was busy falling head over heels for, and Juliet, a younger vampire who had earned the nickname the Duchess of Snark, I survived long enough to learn that the attacking werewolves were members of another pack.
Groan! If you start spouting poetry, I'm leaving.
How about that? I do exist.
Also, with all the descriptions available, from cool to amazing to greatest partner ever, did you have to go with younger?
They were there to make sure the divorce I was settling ended up anything but amicable, opening a path for their pack to move into San Diego and take power. Things were said, plans were hatched, Juliet and I were both kidnapped, and for the second time in a year, Anastasia saved us all.
Your fault, not mine.
She does that a lot.
It's not the only reason I love her, mind you, but it's a damn good one. Admittedly, she can be pretty helpful for a mass murderer.
When the dust settled, the rival pack's infiltration squad was dead, and the divorcing husband and wife, Jason and Caroline, decided to become co-leaders of the world's first werewolf democracy. Also, I convinced Anastasia to go on a date with me. It was awesome, until she disappeared for 6 months. By the time she returned, I'd been hired by the White Ladies of San Diego, female ghosts who had all died to some kind of foul play, to track down their missing leader, Graciela. Meanwhile, Lucia was growing increasingly frustrated with the status quo of our broken vampire-thrall relationship. Juliet had quit the house because there was too much paperwork involved, and had invited herself on at my agency as a junior partner. And, unbeknownst to me, my dad's company was looking at moving to Austin.
Not how I remember it. Please, Juliet, you cried, save my agency.
In the middle of all of that, I made friends with a witch named Nepenthe, who led a coven in Temecula, and seemed convinced she could help finally break the bond between Lucia and me. All she needed was a drop of my blood, and I, every bit as blind as the protagonist of your favorite cautionary tale, didn't see the harm in providing it. Turns out, that was a mistake. Using my freely given blood, the witches were able to siphon Lucia's power and use it to cast ever larger spells that allowed them to continue trapping more and more of the White Ladies, whose souls, in turn, served as batteries for larger incantations. Yeah, the witches were bad. I probably should have seen that one coming.
I don't even have the words.
In the process, they completely upended the bond between Lucia and me in ways that we're both still coming to grips with. As Anastasia, Juliet, and I faced down the coven in their converted warehouse, I found myself calling on Lucia's own vampiric talent to create an icicle the size of a car and skewer a demon who was even larger.
Let's never do that again. Demons suck.
I also killed Nepenthe.
It's something that still haunts me to this day, even though it was her blood that ultimately freed the captured White Ladies and saved the day.
She had it coming. Seriously. Stop beating yourself up over it. It's boring.
Well, that and Lord Beel Kassan making an appearance to save his ageless ward, Ji-sun. That didn't hurt. The good news was that the ghosts were saved and the witches vanquished. The bad news, for Lucia, was that there was yet another coup at the vampire house and, thanks to the witches, she wasn't even conscious to try to stop it. She blames me. I'm pretty sure it was just karma doing its thing. Further stoking the exiled queen's rage, Anastasia, Lucia's oldest friend and servant, finally decided to move forward and continue our relationship.
The plot twist we all saw a mile away.
Which made it all the more shocking when Lucia showed up in my apartment, almost a year later, to tell me that Anastasia had been captured and was being tried for the murder of Lucia's own brother, Tommaso, the vampire king of Europe. After 6 years of private investigation and two of being a mediator, I was suddenly handed a murder case. My only goal, to prove Anastasia's innocence by finding the real killer. It wasn't easy. It wasn't even fun. There were giant roaches, known as the Elutu, mercenaries apparently. There were demons and devils. There was a goddess who called herself Minerva, which I later realized was the Roman name for Athena.
And who you somehow immediately pissed off. Well done.
And there was way too much death. With a lot of help, and even more luck, I stumbled my way into finding the true killers. Lucia's stepmother, who had faked her own death, and Tommaso's bodyguard, Gaius, who had turned traitor for love.
Reason number 12,346, that love is overrated.
In the process, Anastasia asked the queen for her blessing to both court and be courted by me, something I'd assumed we were already doing.
You know what they say about assume.
Oh, and the bond between Lucia and me was twisted even further, to the extent that we started hearing each other's thoughts in our head, not to mention sharing dreams and memories.
I don't even know which of you got the worse end of that deal.
So, a mixed bag, really. In the end, Lucia's exile was lifted, and while she wasn't restored to the throne, she was made queen regent until her niece and Tommaso's daughter, Sabina, was old enough to rule. Either that unexpected victory softened her ice-cold heart, or the fear of losing Anastasia forever forced her hand, because she gave her blessing to our relationship, and even freed Anna from service for a period of time not to exceed 100 years. And that brings us to the here and the now, with Anastasia and me back in San Diego, living the good life, as I run my investigative agency with Juliet and continue to mediate on the side.
I'm pretty sure I do all the running.
Things aren't always perfect, but I can't remember a time when they were better. Which means something bad is probably on its way.
Well, now it definitely is.
I've seen more concise recaps from third graders, John. Next time, stick to the important details, like the amazing business partner and friend who's literally renting you apartment space even as you write this. Sincerely, Juliet. Chapter 1, in which vows are just the beginning. It was a pretty great wedding, until the zombie showed up. September in San Diego meant different things than in the rest of the country. It was warm, but not too warm. The skies were the sort of blue you usually only saw with painted movie sets, and the breeze coming in off the ocean was content with merely rustling the decorations instead of tossing them about like confetti. Even my rented tux fit almost perfectly, rescued by a second round of last-minute alterations. The post-ceremony photos were finally done, with the bride and, well, bride now off getting their solo pictures taken. The rest of us were milling about under the giant open-sided tent that had been erected over the reception tables. 74-degree weather in San Diego didn't mean the sun couldn't still boil you like a lobster if you weren't paying attention. In a few minutes, those of us in the wedding party would have to form back up again to escort and announce the newly married couple to their own reception. But for now, we were scattered about and mixed in with the guests. I had an icy cold beer in one hand and a plateful of cookies in the other, because I'd very nearly overslept for our 8 a.m. rendezvous at the wedding site, and I'd had to skip my usual breakfast on the way. The cookies were amazing. Not breakfast burrito with extra chorizo amazing, obviously, but I wasn't complaining, and the beer was, as always, the perfect post-wedding treat. It had been a season of weddings. Mike and Susan had been the first to start things off back in May, and if Susan had spent the entire rehearsal dinner staring me down over what she'd been told about my best friend's bachelor's party, she'd been nothing but smiles during the wedding itself. June, July, and August had then had two weddings apiece, all for old high school classmates, who had caught the marriage bug and rightly assumed I still lived in San Diego and would show up with gifts if invited. And now this, the final wedding of the season, and the third of those eight where I'd found myself going stag. Thankfully, this time, I knew almost everyone else at the reception. Even better, none of them had tried to kill me in more than a year.
"How's it hanging, son?"
"Hey, Jason," I tapped his beer bottle with mine and tried not to shake my head.
"New look?"
"Yeah.
What do you think?"
For all that he was still only 22, the werewolf was looking almost professorial, in a blazer with honest-to-God leather patches on the elbows. He had tried to complete the ensemble with wire-framed glasses, but the lack of lenses kind of stood out, as did the sheer amount of product he'd worked into his hair. Not to mention that he'd used that product to give himself a faux hawk.
"It's different."
"Yeah," he said. "Got to be all respectable and stuff at events like these, you know? Plus, the chicks dig distinguished these days."
I hadn't noticed.
"It's true. I may be off the market now, but I'm not going to deny the honeys their eye candy."
"Where is Caroline anyway?"
"She's at home," he said. "Was feeling under the weather, so I came to represent the pack instead."
He gave the phrase, "under the weather," special significance, and then looked at me expectantly.
I'm sorry to hear that."
For a second, he just looked at me. Finally, he shook his head and took another swig of beer.
"Son, speaking as one grown-ass adult to another, you can sometimes be really dense, even for a human."
"Let's pretend I have no idea what you're talking about," I said. "Because I don't. Also, why are you calling me son now? What happened to bro?" He rolled his eyes, looking very much like the teenager he'd so recently been.
"It's obvious. I'm going to be a dad soon, so I'm trying it out to see how it feels."
"You're what?"
"Gonna be a dad? Kara's got a couple pups on the way."
"Damn, that's..." I ran through a handful of adjectives, some of them less appropriate than others, before finally settling on something safe. "Amazing! Congratulations, dude!"
"Yeah," he adjusted his lensless glasses and preened. "It's pretty sweet, no lie. We're both young enough still that we've got a good chance of seeing them grow up and have kids of their own."
I managed to hide my wince behind my third-best mediator's smile, recently dubbed the Encourager trademark. Wares personified the phrase, "live fast and die young," with life expectancies that rarely reached the 50s. It was weird and sobering to think that both Jason and his ex-wife, current girlfriend, and soon-to-be baby mama, would likely pass around the same time as my vastly older parents.
"Don't expect me to hand out cigars or any of that shit, though," Jason was saying. "I'm a soon-to-be dad now. I've got to watch my finances."
"No more Wednesday night bar crawls?"
"I'm a dad, not dead."
"Right.
Anyway, what's new?"
He snagged another beer from the nearby table and popped the cap off with his thumb.
"Not a ton. Juliet's holding down the fort on the PI side of things while I deal with the goblins."
I couldn't see my business partner, but I knew she was swanning around the reception somewhere with her plus one. At some point, she'd probably swing by to make fun of my tux again.
"Think the current ceasefire has a better chance of lasting than the last two?"
The Encourager trademark cracked under the weight of a question it wasn't qualified to answer, and I shrugged.
"We'll see, I guess. The only thing worse than a land war in Asia is a land war with goblins. The Myr are sponsoring the newest round of negotiations, and they want me on hand to work some mediator magic. I guess I should just be grateful they didn't invite Kayla von Stahl instead. My rival, sort of, mediator, usually covered the coastal territories while I handled the rest. But that arrangement hadn't kept him from bogarting mediation cases in the past. Jason whistled.
I don't care what everyone else says about you, bro. You've got balls of solid steel. I mean, mad respect and all, but that was seriously cold.
Now I was back to being bro.
What are you talking about?
Come on. It's not like you left them much choice. They needed a mediator, and you're the only one around not pushing up daisies.
Caleb von Stahl is dead?
Jason just looked at me for a while, and for the first time in our strange relationship, I saw something like respect in his gaze.
Bro, you're gonna have to teach me how to do that. If I didn't know better, I think you were surprised to hear it.
Because I am surprised.
This is me you're talking to. J-Money, dog of dogs, and your bro before all hoes. There's no need to front like you didn't do it.
I was still grappling with the loss of my long-assumed, if slow-to-develop, bromance with the other mediator, so Jason's words didn't sink in until well after the fact. When they did, I nearly choked on my latest sip of beer.
You think I killed him?
We were in the middle of a wedding, and not all of the attendees were supernatural, so I kept my voice quiet. There were only so many times you could laugh off awkward conversations as jokes or movie quotes.
Of course not. Jason dropped his voice to match mine. Everyone knows you had your girlfriend do it.
My girlfriend, and it still made me giddy to even think the word, was none other than Lady Anastasia Dumanova, a 400-some-old-year vampire who, through the grace of the demigod of unexpected romantic pairings, had for some reason taken a liking to me. And yeah, for most of her centuries-old existence, she'd been her queen's secundus, both fixer and assassin. But that wasn't who she was anymore. She didn't kill on anyone's command, and if she'd decided to off Caleb on her own, I was sure she'd have told me. Mostly sure.
Jason, I began. Say no more, son. He straightened his glasses and took a long glance around us. This is neither the time nor the place, you feel me? Emilio's throwing a barbecue 2 Wednesdays from now after the pack meeting. You can drop on by and give us the word then.
Before I could reply, or even ask if Emilio was still the owner of the world's greatest mustache, Jason was gone, making a beeline for the last plate of cookies and what I suspected would be his 4th or even 5th beer of the wedding. I went to follow him, but was intercepted by a red-headed, blue-eyed, mediator-seeking missile in a tux of her own.
John!
Darlene! I hugged her back and saluted her with my mostly empty beer bottle.
Mazel tov. How did you like your surprise?
She turned to regard the 2 people standing on the far side of the tent, talking to a woman who looked even taller and more beautiful than usual, in her white silk wedding dress. While Kayla was a vampire, the people she was entertaining were human, a middle-aged woman with Darlene's eyes and a radiant smile, and a gawky, red-headed teenage boy, whose resemblance to his newly married sister was almost uncanny.
I still can't believe it, Darlene told me. How did you get Mom and Josh to come?
Hey, I'm the best man, or maid of honor?
Best man of honor.
Right, that. Miracles are kind of what we do.
I turned back from the side of Darlene's mom and brother to regard the woman herself. Honestly, it didn't take much convincing. I'm just sorry I couldn't talk your dad into joining them.
I'm not. He had his chance and made his choice, 2 times over.
Darlene shook her head
and her smile made a reappearance, so wide on her small, freckled face that it almost looked crazed.
"I'm just so grateful that my old family gets to meet my new one. I swear they're both halfway in love with Kay already. Thank you."
"Consider it my apology for not being able to attend the festivities in Australia, and for Anna's absence today." Kayla's former house, and her entire extended family, was in Australia. Rather than force either the San Diegans or the Australians to travel, the pair had elected to have weddings in both locations. And if it hadn't been for my role in hopefully helping to end a goblin war, not to mention my thoroughly mixed feelings on airplanes, I'd have been going down under to celebrate the second one, too.
"You know you're already forgiven for both."
"I did, but it was nice to hear anyway." "So, how does it feel to be Mrs. and Mrs. finally?"
This time her whole face glowed. "I think it's still sinking in. Have you seen Kay in her wedding dress? How the hell did I get so lucky?"
"By being awesome enough to deserve it."
That earned me a second hug. But before I could say anything more, the DJ was waving at us from across the room. On the far side of the tent, the rest of the wedding party was gathering in pairs, Kayla among them.
"Looks like it's processional time again," I told Dee, turning her about. "Shall we?"
I sat with the rest of the wedding party at the main table, which put me in a strange mix of company. A couple of Darlene's fellow recent graduates from UCSD, a handful of vampires from the San Diego house, and one bark-skinned woman with dark, luxurious vines for hair, who I was pretty sure was a dryad. Like many of the less human-looking attendants, that woman, Brooke, was no doubt wearing a glamour to let her pass as human amongst those ignorant to the existence of supernaturals. Thanks to me being me, I couldn't actually see that glamour. But her bark skin went well with the off-the-shoulder, deep-green wedding dresses that Kayla had picked out for her bridesmaids. And if flowers tended to bloom wherever she stood for any length of time, well, they just added to the decor. Only two of us at the table were men, and I couldn't help but sense that the second one had been trying to make eye contact with me throughout the meal, long after we'd all stumbled our way through our respective speeches. My relationship with Steve was complicated, and not just because he was a vampire ninja who had probably never even heard of acne. Part of me was simply bummed that he'd shaved the mohawk that had always been a close second to Emilio's glorious mustache in the citywide hair and facial hair rankings. But our real issues were entirely political. Steve hadn't directly taken part in the coup that overthrew their former house's leader, Lucia Borghese, vampire queen and my supposed mistress, but he hadn't joined in the small exodus that followed either. Instead, he'd opted to support the new leader, Duke Bajos, only to have Bajos flee both house and country a year later when Lucia's vigilante accountant, Marcus, had gotten his revenge. It was all a mess, and the upshot was that Steve and I hadn't shared more than a few words over the course of the last year, despite both being in Kay and Dee's wedding party. But, I decided, belly comfortably full of my second slice of wedding cake, enough is enough. Lucia's back in Rome with the den of snakes, sometimes literal snakes, that she prefers, and I'm frankly sick of vampire politics getting in the way of friendship. I washed down that last bite of cake with champagne that was far too expensive for me to properly appreciate, and looked across the table at Steve, raising my glass to him in a silent toast. He returned it with a smile, teeth gleaming against the darkness of his skin, and just like that, all was well. Or so I thought. A half hour later, with the reception lunch over and the party now in full swing, Steve sought me out where I was wallflowering to one side of the freshly assembled dance floor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?